Peter, we've just finished recording episode 5 of the Trustful Your Dead Tech podcast with Kevin Still. I thought that was another really good conversation, touching on some of the areas he's engaged with MAPS on around the projected increase in demand for debt advice over the next year or two. And obviously, we expanded on that as the theme. He knows his stuff, Kevin, doesn't he?
He does. It was really content rich. Some excellent answers. I found myself sort of sitting there nodding away in thorough agreement with a lot of things he said, to be honest.
Yeah. So we probably went over as we expected would happen, but not by too much. I think Kevin is another one, like many of our guests, we'd say we need to get back on and drill into some of those other areas that we maybe just touched on high level. But yeah, another really good listen for our huge and growing audience across the world.
He touched on some great subjects, actually. One of them to do with, you know, standards in debt advice and how consumer duty is going to make even those organisations or sort of smaller advisors that are grandfathered over when regulation took place, it's going to really force them to all come to the same sort of standard, whether they're free to use or not. I think that's really good. And some of his comments on you know, how digital tools can be used to help, which is what these podcasts are all about, help debt advisors was really interesting. One of the things I wanted to ask him in a way, but we didn't really find the opportunity, was, you know, how do we help those people decide which way to get into debt advice? And that's always a perennial problem, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think that touches on the area when we talked about having the right people around the table informing these decisions, and that includes people who are doing the job on a daily basis, who understand these people, what drives the decisions and the behaviours, who quite often people are under very stressful circumstances, so the behaviours might change, and having frontline debt advisors involved in the design and delivery of any new process or policy, I think, is fundamental, and that's probably something we all agreed on as part of the podcast.
Well, let's let people listen to it, and should we run titles?
Let's run the titles.
Okay, here we go.
The Dead Tech Podcast with Peters and Lee.
No, it's not Peters and Lee, it's Peter and Lee.
Well, if Carlsberg made this, they wouldn't make one like I've had. I've just deleted all my notes.
I wasn't quite sure whether this is going to be a Monty Python scheme that I've come here for an argument or a debate.
Ooh, that's a good question.
You haven't got an auto remover, have you?
No.
Yeah, that was very diplomatic, but the short answer is Nottingham Forest.
The only difference I know between Crystal Palace and Cappuccino is Cappuccino stays in the cup for longer.
He has many fantastic credits, not quite as many as Oscar Wilde.
I've got faith in both of you, so.
And a bloody good lawyer. I was told the other day I've got a very good face for podcasts. I thought, oh, thanks for that.
The Dead Tech Podcast with Peter and Lee.
Hello and welcome to episode 5 of the Trustfolio Debt Tech Podcast. My name is Leosha and I'm joined by my regular co-host, Peter Walwork. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Lee. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. Good. And delighted to introduce today's guest, who many of you will have heard of before, Mr. Kevin Still, who is Director at DEMSA, Principal Consultant at Kevin Still Consulting, and also author of the brilliant DEMSA news bulletins, which usually come out or come into your inbox over the weekend. So I'm just new to those bulletins, Kevin, which I find fantastic, by the way. How are you today?
Very well, yeah. As you say on the bulletins, I try and take a lighter-hearted view of life because compliance and regulatory matters can be a bit heavy and turgid at times. So trying to strike that right balance in a world where we've got a lot of things facing us, like consumer duty, cost of living crisis. I think it's quite important to actually still see a lighter side of life.
100%. And I think you get that balance really well. So anyone who's not onto the bulletins, do sign up. How do they sign up anyway, Kevin, if they're not receiving
it? It's been a process really of almost osmosis over the course of time, that what used to be primarily a member bulletin You know, we've got a readership now probably of over 400. And that ranges from anything from debt advice, debt solution providers, a lot of debt purchasers, debt collectors. And because of my stint with Capgemini, HMRC, then extended into the systems integrators that we worked with, your Pegas of this world. And then increasingly over the course of time, more and more fintechs are entering the market and working with firms that now do income optimization, integration, affordability assessment. So your Paylinks, your IE hubs, and then more recently your policy and practice invest. And so the story goes on. Yeah. And a lot of them have used the FCA sandbox or similar. And I'd just like to feel that we can sort of bring those into the fraternity, as it were, because they're all part of this wider ecosystem we're looking at. And I think Peter will probably remember from his days in the CSA that the blurring of the lines between what is debt management and what is debt resolution now is becoming increasingly difficult to determine at times, particularly where forbearance is to the fore.
Yeah. Well, we might touch on that as we go through the podcast. But, I mean, yeah, it's great. 400 readers of the bulletin is good. We'll promote that across the debt tech audience. So we'll try and bump that up to 410 over the next few weeks and beyond.
How many?
So in terms of the theme today, Peter and I, when preparing for the podcast, we'll find it difficult really to narrow down to one particular thing with yourself, given the area involvement that you have across all of those areas you've just mentioned, I suppose, collections, regulation, debt advice and beyond. But before we get into that, Kevin, we know you're a big rugby fan and we wanted you to settle a debate that we're having on our Exco call this morning. And the question was, what's a tougher sport, rugby league or rugby union?
Exactly. I think it probably depends on the position that you play. I'm a former prop forward, and I would say generally from a rugby union perspective, that's a much tougher occupation where you've actually genuinely got to push and get your body closer to the ground. But when you look at the type of hits that you see, what I would say is that rugby league, particularly with people like Sean Edwards, have brought in a lot more into the tackling, you know, top and tailing players, which is in part resulting a lot of the type of injuries you're now beginning to see versus the old traditional ones where people tackled around the ankles. So I'd say definitely the position you play, but what you're seeing is a different shape of player as a consequence of rugby league. Sort of height isn't a particular importance. You know, line-outs have no significance, but you're now seeing sort of Joe and Alomu-sized players all over the pitch. And sometimes that can be pretty terrifying when you've got a winger who's 18 stone plus and running sub 11 second 100 metres.
Yeah. At the speed they're running now, it's a much faster game. I mean, Peter was telling us he used to be tough on the tackle when he was in his younger days.
Let me just clarify this. I'm only 5 foot six and a half on a good day. And that ankle tackling, I was good at that.
I'll put it in perspective, a quick soundbite. I played against Martin O'Fire many, many years ago in the 80s when he was still at, I think it was Roslyn Park, and he was regarded as a bit soft then, and he moved up to Widnes first before going to Wigan, and they certainly toughened him up and sped him up a bit. I think he played in a match where he scored 10 tries. And then my former club, Haverteeth, were at the Twickenham Sevens when Wigan were allowed to come into the event. And if you can imagine a team with Martin O'Fire, Jason Robinson, Henry Paul, Ellery Hanley, Tugi Mala, Sean Edwards were just part of that team. And they conceded to one of my very old clubs, Harlequins, four tries to start off with and then just got into overdrive. And, you know, the speed, the skill and the strength were just astonishing.
So that's a claim to fame to see you've played with those guys, because I don't know much about
rugby. I didn't actually play with them. I was actually at the event coaching our team. My days of seven lasted when I was about 17, when I could raise a bit of puff, but I was never blessed with pace.
Well, you're in the same place.
This is going to sound really dodgy, but the the closest I came to Sean Edwards was sharing the sauna with him. and it wasn't dodgy at all. There were others in there at the same time.
Well, that's probably a good point to move on from the rugby discussion. And
about Sting.
We could probably do a separate podcast on that altogether. So anyway, let's move on to the area we did agree to focus on today. And Kevin, that's your engagement with MAPS around the future demand for debt advice. Something that every year seems to be talked about, and every year it seems to become more and more important, the delivery of good quality debt advice. So what are MAPS preparing for, in your view, in terms of the projected increase in demand, and what will be the main accelerators for that, do you think?
So I think along with all of the other remits they have, particularly to the likes of Treasury, and we've just come off the back of the first round, you know, of major consultation on the statutory debt repayment plans, which requires good information in terms of what volumes actually look like. And I think it was fairly clear that the impact assessment that Treasury put together was somewhat off the mark, and particularly when we relate that to breathing space, that the first year's volumes were less than 10% of the original forecast. So getting these numbers right is pretty important. Casting your net to the actual practitioners, I think, is really crucial. So, you know, not only listening to your step changes, your pay plans, your community debt advice, but all providers, and looking at why certain triggers are going upwards, why other areas are still very, you know, subdued. And that was certainly the case through the pandemic when, for example, Step Change launched their COVID recovery plan. You know, lots of strong merits and good points, but it was premature because the government and a lot of the FCA forbearance schemes came into play, and we didn't see the tsunami in demand at that time. So I think the key to this is, are we going to get a major spike? Is that going to be caused by the cost of living crisis on top of everything else, or is it going to be more smoothed? Are there going to be other forbearance measures in play? And certainly FCA have been very strong that they are supervising very carefully. So MAPS at the moment have gone back out. They're using a statistician to try and actually update some of those numbers. And when we were helping with that, in part, Natasha has sent out a call to action to see if we can get as good a quality information as we can do from across the board. So I'm by no means unique in that. But we've used the bulletin to facilitate that, Lee, and that's enabled a lot of providers, so your financial wellness groups, your pay plans and others, to have one-to-one sessions where they can talk a little bit more openly about what they're doing, what they're seeing. And there's some good examples of that we've covered recently in the bulletins, where particularly with the likes of PayLink now engaging with a lot more of the tier one banks with more automated means coming straight out of the recoveries area, creditor referrals then, rather than just being signposting, are much more direct to source. So the customer's actually directly communicating, completing their income and expenditure, using the likes of open banking, income optimization, for some of the ones, non-financial services, looking at social tariffs more broadly. But rather than at the end of it saying, do you want to actually speak to a debt advisor, they're using their debt advice permissions electronically to determine whether they will be better suited to be directly relayed to a debt advisor rather than return to collections in the bank.
Yeah.
And some banks themselves have policies that if they find multiple debts across multiple creditors, then taking a unilateral approach isn't the right way to do it, and actually better to do a holistic review. And where income and expenditures like your IE hubs do can be shared with multiple creditors. And again, that tell me once approach is an important one for many consumers. And when we talk about that in vulnerability as well, why does it take so many handoffs to actually get a common piece of information to the right places? So I think that's very important. And I think what the Money and Pension Service want to look at, particularly with the Lot 1 awards, which is the National Debt Advice Commissioning, which is incredibly imminent now. You know, it's the second bite at this, but they're due to be announced in early September. So there'll be a number of big providers on tender hooks at the moment for implementation in February. And the reality is that funding's crucial, and everybody wants to know, is it going to be servicing much, much higher demand, or is that going to gradually creep up? How is digital engagement going to factor into that? Because it is an objective of what they're looking to do, and look at the different channels. And how do you integrate community debt advice into that, which has been problematic, and not without the issues that you flagged, Lee, regarding the recent Credit Services Association paper on do you get value for money out of debt advice? So making all this more joined up is key. Establishing these ecosystems is important. And then alongside it, you've got things like quality frameworks. So there have been a couple of prior information notices and potential bidders been invited in to look at how we actually manage and have oversight of the quality of debt advice, which to me is vitally important, irrespective of whether that's a profit-seeking firm or a not-for-profit firm.
100% on that. And I know it's a contentious area, and we're going to cover that at the next MALG forum in the Northeast, and you're going to support that session as well. But for me, there's different outcomes we need to be looking at in terms of measuring the quality of debt advice. And one of the key ones is really demonstrating where the value does lie, because funding's an issue. We've talked about that. And if you can demonstrate that value to the funders in a more effective way that's happening now, there may be more receptive, some of those creditors who don't fund debt advice, to maybe get involved in that in the conversation going forward. The other thing I wanted to pick up on there, you mentioned the cost of living crisis. So when we project figures going forward, looking at demand for debt advice increasing, this is looked at every year, and I've been involved in this sector for a number of years now. Probably for the first time, I'm starting to look at the demand increasing much greater than it has done before. I was listening to Alison Dunn, who's CEO of Gateshead Citizens Advice, but she's also a director of strategy at Gateshead City Council. And she was talking about worst case scenarios in terms of people struggling just in their jurisdiction on the Jeremy Vine show this morning. And it's worrying. It's really worrying when you look at the fuel increases, that's going to impact people who've never been impacted maybe before. All of that's got to go into the mix. And then you look at the impact on debt advice. There's not the numbers of debt advisors out there to support face-to-face sessions or telephone sessions for all of those people who might need it. So you've then got to look at digital solutions. Is that something at the forefront for MAPS, do you think, in terms of looking at digital tools, really, to deliver some sort of...
I wouldn't necessarily say it's right at the forefront. It's certainly a major consideration. And if you look at it more generally, not just within MAPS, but other government agencies, you know, and we're still hiding a little bit behind, I'll be fairly candid here, the pandemic in most contact centres. You know, how many times have you heard as a punter calling in that you've called at an incredibly busy time, you know, your call's important to us? Well, to me, I mutter to myself when I'm on these calls, and that is you don't have enough operators on shift. And your planning should be far more effective. You can't hide behind COVID anymore. And there are a number of factors behind that. But to me, that's a really important part of the consumer duty, you know, which says customer services, communications, capacity, they're all parts of your service if you've got the right operational resilience and financial resilience. And to me, that they are a factor in the debt advice sector, which said when community debt advice shut down during the pandemic, what was plan B? And for some of those that didn't have a plan B or a plan C model relative to hybrid working, you need to think about that and how that's going to be on. Now, it may not be perfect, but I would rather have a fallback contingency plan of digital debt advice than no plan at all. So some of this is worst case scenario. It's bit, you know, it's business continuity planning. Others, it's actually catering for an audience that do want to engage that way. So when you look at this, again, relative to some of the things we're doing with the FCA innovation team, where they're looking to promote digital debt advice, what we're seeing is some of the pioneers in here who've been through this, like Angel Advance, like FWG, where 84% of the people have got a smartphone and would prefer to do that. And indeed, for those that have engaged through their creditors digitally, that's not just buy now, pay later, can be anything. That's their preference in terms of mode of engagement. So I think there is a big audience that's underserved at the moment, but we do need to recognise those that are not best served through that medium and don't force people down that route. but, you know, maybe being slightly contentious, you've got to make a distinction between those people where it's the obvious choice to use traditional face-to-face communication means versus where it is an option, it's a menu option, where it's not affordable. You know, and I think the thing that we've seen within this is if you look at it critically, many of the people that were saying should be using face-to-face at the moment do have alternative medium available to you. So if the chips are right down and money is an issue, which it is, then we need to focus very much on those that need to be served because it is the right way of engaging with people. And I think that is one of the debates we skirt around the handbags all the time and we need to tackle quite clearly because it is relevant to that MAPS model. If you are going to have three funded national debt advice providers, they need to be able to integrate debt, community debt advice into that model effectively, where it becomes really apparent early on that that person needs to speak to somebody face-to-face or through a different medium. Now, the fact is, for those people, particularly those in more rural areas, they're not going to be able to walk into Leeds High Street or Central City Centre. They don't go into the CAB or the local community advice as the first port of call. They have to come in through a traditional telephone or internet-type communication medium. It's only then that you want to actually triage them to the right source of advice afterwards. So it's got to be a collaborative exercise. It, you know, and for me, sometimes I sit on the periphery of this because I'm not involved in the MAPS funding directly. And you're looking at how you collaborate within the ecosystem, not how you're constantly competing probably for the same funding or that one route delivers a better outcome than others. And at the moment, you know, for me, there is a large section of the regulated community that were grandfathered in that have got to face up to the fact that they have got to adhere to the same regulated standards as everybody else that is regulated. And to me, the consumer duty is forcing that upon every regulated form. We talked about credit unions. Again, that's a direct consequence of them being dual regulated, but often with volunteers. You know, and their DSCEO letters, whilst mindful of the fact they're trying to offer a great service to their members, they are light on infrastructure compared to tier one banks, challenger banks and other financial services firms that would have that infrastructure embedded from day one because it's an absolute basic hygiene level.
Yeah. Do you think the right people are involved in that debate? Because you make a relevant point around trying to find a way to channel the right people to the right advice for them. And if you speak to some debt advisors, they would say everyone would benefit from face-to-face or more hands-on debt advice, if you like, whereas others would see it slightly differently. From a creditor perspective, I've seen evidence which suggests when we've developed referral options for customers, there was a big percentage who preferred not to speak to anyone and they want to do everything digital. But I suppose that depends on how good the digital tools are and how easy they are for those in debt to use them. But what one thing I do see is a common theme, that the people don't feel as though there's enough on-the-ground advisors involved in the decision-making.
No, I tend to agree with you in terms of how we make best use of the resources. And again, you know, it doesn't all have to be one channel. You know, what we increasingly see now is people wanting to do the easy things digitally. And I can speak to that directly from doing 2 years at HMRC on a contact engagement strategy. People who want to change their tax code, you know, using my voice as my password, going onto a digital channel, doing something in 5 minutes because they've got a personal tax account. It's great. But take a more complex transaction with exactly the same person in a different moment in time, and they will want to come in through a different medium that suits them for the complexity of that transaction. And I think that's going to be increasingly common now. What we're seeing is some very, very clever tooling that can be readily used from tools that everybody's got. As I say, a smartphone is a very common appliance now, even for the people that are hardest up. And when you look at some of those now with things like conversational AI, there are some remarkably good results coming out of that in terms of completing something like a standard financial statement, which requires no advice whatsoever at that point. collecting what we call artifacts now, but bits of evidence that relate to, you know, proving their income and giving enough confidence to creditors that what they're seeing is the truth. That can form the first part, a more laborious part of a process, before you actually have a quality conversation that may only last 5 minutes.
Yeah.
There's a big difference between doing that and having a 55-minute call where you're going to talk about bankruptcy or insolvency at the end, by which time somebody's lost the will to live. Yeah. You know, and for a lot of the more attuned advisors, trying to work out whether they're driving their car or doing the washing up at the same thing. So what percentage of brain have you got at any moment in time is critical. You know, so there are a lot of ways that we can improve advisor efficiency and their well-being as well, which is pretty important, particularly as many of them have been working in a hybrid environment for some time. But it still doesn't get away from the fact that if we look at this and the expected demand, there's going to be a shortfall. And some channels will work better. And some people are more accomplished in one channel than another. You know, trying to turn a face-to-face advisor into a telephone advisor is difficult, and vice versa.
Yeah.
You know, we found when you had to move circa 20-odd thousand people off the telephones out of call centers to become web chat agents running concurrent discussions, some of them thrived, some of them really found it an absolute nightmare. And along with that came God knows how many other compliance issues in terms of running concurrent dialogues going on to make sure that the right record was recorded against the right person. So I think when we look at these ecosystems, sometimes you've got to look at how all that glues together and how you are able to hand off effectively where the customer journey is the priority to different specialisms. And that goes for vulnerability. It goes for things like income optimization. It goes to delivery of advice. And I think that's the area where often you find public-private sector collaboration is very important. And I think I learned a lot of lessons when working in the public sector using trusted private sector providers who are well versed in bidding into that. And Peter will be familiar with that with Crown Commercial Services and things like the debt resolution service framework and how people like Indesa, TDX Group, Sopra Stereo run in that environment, understanding the new government standards, which can be pretty tough, but so especially around social value and disruptive technology, alongside bringing some best practices from the commercial sector. And that collaboration's got to be there. And we can't keep going on about fee charges. But actually, when we look at something like statutory debt repayment plans, if it worked and it was a mainstream debt solution, and that's a big if, it needs some changes, you would have a free-to-consumer solution from all. What we should be worrying about then is not the providers of the advice, it's the infrastructure that sits underneath it, probably sucking away a lot of the funding, where you are going to have big systems integrators working with the insolvency service. And nobody's questioning their bids when it comes in at 100 million quid or something similar. And believe me, that the debt respite scheme, breathing space, coming in at the volume it did, meant when people look back within government, DWP, HMRC, at what they spent on implementing that and go back and look at a cost-benefit analysis, and it's just not justifiable. And you think of something of a quantum leap like statutory debt repayment plans, what we're getting at the moment is it looks like a damp squib, feels like a damp squib, and unless somebody turns it into a mainstream debt remedy by talking within the industry to make it right and fit and flexible enough, then it will be. But if it were got right, it achieves a lot of the goals in allowing a lot more capacity into the market with more innovation and gets away from this profit or not-for-profit. You know, there's a cap on what you can recover, and you've got to work within that to determine whether you can make a margin or not and deliver to a quality standard and a consumer duty that is meaningfully higher than what many facets of the debt advice sector are used to working to at the moment.
It's quite difficult to jump in and ask you a question, because I have to say I agree with what you're saying. really, on pretty much every count you've spoken about so far, especially on the SDRP front.
Well, you've written your own blog on that. I don't know if it's been published yet, Peter, but it's probably along a similar theme to what Kevin's just discussed there. Yeah,
it is. I think it's. I think we've got to go back and think again. Personally, I've been reading a lot of responses. I've read Dempsey's response and all the work you've written on it, Kevin. And there's elements in there which I'm partway through writing a piece at the moment, but. Part of what you said about, existing regulators possibly, using a bit more muscle with their respective, the firms that they regulate, wouldn't be a bad idea. You mentioned UK regulators network in one of your pieces. We were trying to do that at the CSA. We tried to get the UKRN to get its members, other than FCA, to adopt the CSA code of practice, at least. Ofwat did. But they weren't really interested, and it disappoints me a little bit. I see some of the things that SDRP is trying to do to curb the more aggressive collectors, if you like, that aren't currently covered by FCA regulation. I think there are other regulators that could do it quite quickly as well. We don't have to wait for an SDRP to come in a couple of years.
And I totally agree with you on that, Peter. I think what we're going to see is it's going to be used as a catalyst because the cost of living crisis is so acute now. Mm. To focus on the problematic ones. And energy, you've got to start with energy, in reality. When you're looking at facing an 80% hike in October, many people have already been struggling up to now, and the situation could get worse. That do you treat people differently who could still afford what they're paying now, but can't afford everything if it goes up by 80%? Yeah. Do you upset the whole apple cart? So all of the other unsecured creditors, priority creditors, or do you come up with protocols that work effectively where the consumer ultimately hasn't really been responsible for over-borrowing or any form of reckless use of credit in this particular instance? And some of the principles behind statutory debt repayment plans need to be taken more informally and deployed across the industry, where what I do know is the CSA will probably be more proactive in looking at that universally and then working out, particularly with some of the Ofgem members, at what point in time is it worthwhile moving that client to somebody that does adhere to the FCA regulations. Mm. And that may not be escalation. That may actually be a safety blanket. And I think we've collectively discussed this before, with buy now, pay later before. Are you in a better place when you actually get moved to a regulated firm than an unregulated firm doing whatever they feel like in terms of early arrears management? And to me, I don't necessarily see that as escalation. I see it going to the right party that is well-versed in what won't be treating customers fairly anymore, but adherence to PRIN 12 and the new rules once the six outcomes get set aside. And that, to me, is another massive challenge for firms at the moment. It's not just the pyrotechnics of understanding what's in the new policy statement and non-handbook guidance, but the difficulty with principle-based regulations is the outcome-based part. And we've got to come up with some really tangible KPIs, KRIs and the like that said, how do I evidence that I am actually delivering the right outcomes? And sometimes that's going to be a critical assessment when you're looking at some of these clients now, where you can see an early barometer of what's going on. And I'm speaking at the Vulnerability Summit around gambling. And it's less about the gambling and the switches that you can switch on and off. It's actually the implications on lenders in terms of, can I second guess why this person's borrowing some money? And if there is evidence there and you've got the evidence, why didn't you use it? There's always a trade-off there. We used to have it in debt advice that if you were doing credit reports and you were using open banking, then you tried to use that as fully as you possibly could. But people who didn't use it operated to a different standard, but they weren't assessed because it wasn't a critical requirement of that assessment. And therefore, you could end up with a situation that one firm is penalized for doing more than somebody else who's just gone for vanilla and mediocrity is okay. And what I see with the consumer duty is actually there's no hiding places anymore. You need to be doing these. And an interesting point that one of my members raised, Peter, the other day was, why is it the collector's got to operate to higher standards than the lender did when they onboarded the client? I'm sure that was a constant flea in your ear from many of your members. But it's the same in the debt advice sector now. We're looking and seeing a brand new set of standards coming in, which said when you look at these clients, not only from the commercial side of it, should they be with a commercial provider, but where are the alternatives? Where do you send some of these clients that have got a multitude of vulnerabilities, some of which you can pick up by the client disclosing them, but others you're having to do that, by being Inspector Clouseau, you're having to look at what's coming out of the bank statements, what's coming out of the open banking, and then persuading somebody that it's in their best interest to disclose that information. So it's some really tough challenges, and I think some of those are going to be very acute in some sectors that are already high risk. But, I'd like to see some of that go further up the chain to the onboarding stages and the financial promotions, because that still terrifies me when you look at some of the, the adverts on television about how easy it is to invest, equally well, how easy it is to borrow, and some of the advertisement that goes along with that. And, aside from my Advertising Standards Association note in the bulletin around foul language and what constitutes foul language, there are more generic ones in terms of how you market to different audiences and what an average customer is, which there's been quite a big debate on that in the Consumer Duty.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, that's another area we could cover on a separate podcast in much more detail, but that's something I've been concerned about for a number of years now in terms of how lending is marketed to certain cohorts of people. I did have another question, but we're probably going to run over if I asked that question, because it could wrangle on, and it was around the creditor side, because we talk a lot about advice sector and MAPS, and we don't really focus as much on the creditor side and what they're going to need to do really to manage this crisis that's going to impact their bottom line in terms of collections, what they can recover, but also the cost of collections versus customers who just can't afford to pay anything, and what's the solution there? But that's probably a meaty conversation.
I could probably give you a quick soundbite really around that, and in terms of one of your earlier questions on accelerators, because I do definitely see that there are a number of creditors now, including the essential service providers, so relating back to UKRN, your Ofwats, your Ofgems at the moment, and Ofcoms, where you're seeing meaningful cohorts of clients that are probably on the priority service register, but that's not clean very often. It's not a great source of data, where those groups are trying to get a better view of those customers, engage with them, but using third parties. They are in the commercial sector, but they're there to go off and establish financial wellbeing hubs or the like. So like we've recently seen with Income Max replatforming to Salesforce with Hope Massey. So they can take on an order of 10 increase in the number of consumers they can service, so that people can get a better view as what their true state of play is. But the portal is a consumer portal, which is important. So the data's theirs. And they then decide what they share then back with one or more creditors afterwards. But what the creditors are doing is giving that customer every chance of identifying early problem debt, close to overdraft, persistent debt, are you paying more in interest than you are off the balance? Mm-hmm. Energy, where you are seeing already that the direct debit is a shortfall, so you're going to have a deficit budget at some point in time. So all of those triggers used more intelligently to try and engage with a certain proportion of your customers, some of them who may have characteristics of vulnerability, and then the consumer, the customer, the small business can then decide whether they want to share and return that data back, but on their own terms. So I'm beginning to see that, and I see that as a major driver for debt advice. It will come through that, I think, rather than through your money helper, where historically we've seen, and I used to say it took 9 months to do something about your debts. PayPlan and others would say it's even longer. And what we're trying to do is actually shorten that period where somebody decides it's the right thing for them to do. And they don't rack up any more debts in those periods, because that often creates the tension, is in that period of contemplation, they do borrow more. they borrow the wrong type of funding, so it tends to be higher cost. And often there's bad will then with the creditors that were last in, because they will make a view that as probable fraud. You know, so there are a lot of things here in terms of encouraging better engagement where these people aren't alone. You know, when I was at HMRC, we had to pay out 14 million people. That wasn't the role of HMRC. So it was a very alien concept, but there was that's a massive cohort of people that you know that were impacted by an event.
Yeah.
Cost of living is going to be the same thing at the moment. And it's not your bottom two quintiles. It's significantly more than that. So using that intelligence, to me, is really important, and giving the consumer the opportunity to do something about it. And that is likely to trigger earlier engagement in debt advice. And to me, that's quite an important element here in understanding that channel and the role that creditors have got to play.
Again, I agree. And I think that's probably a really good point to end the discussion around on today's podcast. It's been really interesting hearing your views, Kevin, around the really important issues that's going to affect us all. And our CEO, Lou, said something yesterday which resonated, that when you're designing solutions or digital tools, and this is not just relating to us but other fintechs, you've got to consider all stakeholders, the customer, the advisor, the creditor or the insolvency practitioner, whoever it may be. And I think it's only when you do that you get to good outcomes that really benefit everyone involved. So, look, thank you very much for your time. We could have went on for another half an hour at least, I think. So we'll definitely be inviting you back.
I'm pleased I resolved the rugby debate.
I'm not sure you did, really. Yeah.
I wasn't quite sure whether this was going to be a Monty Python scheme that I've come here for an argument or a debate, but I think it turned into a debate.
Yeah, definitely agree with that.
We've only charged you for a 5 minutes argument, no, don't worry.
So, yeah, Kevin, thank you for your time. Peter, thank you as well. And that is a wrap for episode 5 of the Trustfolio Debt Tech podcast.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Well, there's podcast number 5 completed. If you've made it this far, you're almost a veteran listener. Feel free to pat yourself generously on the back. I hope you enjoyed listening to us talking with Kevin Still. I know we certainly did. Remember to look out for podcast number 6, which we'll be recording in the next few weeks. The guest we've invited is currently on holiday, but we hope to be able to announce their name very shortly. Whoever we interview, the topic will be how they, from their position of expertise, see digital resources being used to help debt advisors make the most of the time they have with their clients. In the meantime, if you'd like to know a bit more about what we lovingly call Debt Tech, head over to trustfolio.co.uk on the World Wide Web.